On March 4th, 1933, after beating out the incumbent Herbert Hoover in the presidential election, Franklin Delano Roosevelt delivers his first inaugural address.
This is a day of national consecration. And I am certain that on this day, my fellow Americans expect that on my induction into the presidency, I will address them with a candor and a decision which the present situation of our people impels. So first of all, let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror which paralyzes needed efforts to convert retreat into advance. We face our common difficulties. They concern, thank God, only material things. The withered leaves of industrial enterprise lie on every side. Farmers find no market for their produce, and the savings of many years in thousands of families are gone. More important, a host of unemployed citizens face the grim problem of existence, and an equally great number toil with little return. Only a foolish optimist can deny the dark realities of the moment. And yet we are stricken by no plague of locusts. Compared with the perils which our forefathers conquered, we have still much to be thankful for. Nature still offers her bounty, and human efforts have multiplied it. Plenty is at our doorstep. Practices of the unscrupulous money changers stand indicted in the court of public opinion, rejected by the hearts and minds of men. Yes, the money changers have fled from their high seats in the temple of our civilization. We may now restore that temple to the ancient truth. This nation is asking for action, and action now. There must be a strict supervision of all banking and credit and investment. There must be an end to speculation with other people's money. And there must be provision for an adequate but sound currency. These, my friends, are the lines of attack. I shall presently urge upon a new Congress in special session detailed measures for their fulfillment. And I shall seek the immediate assistance of the 48 states. I am prepared, under my constitutional duty, to recommend the measures that a stricken nation in the midst of a stricken world may require. These measures, or such other measures, as the Congress may build out of its experience and wisdom, I shall seek within my constitutional authority to bring to speedy adoption. But in the event that the Congress shall fail to take one of these two courses, in the event that the national emergency is still critical, I shall not evade the clear course of duty that will then confront me. I shall ask the Congress for the one remaining instrument to meet the crisis: broad executive power to wage a war against the emergency as great as the power that would be given to me if we were in fact invaded by a foreign foe. In this dedication of a nation, we humbly ask the blessing of God. May he protect each and every one of us. May he guide me in the days to come.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. If you're just joining us, we're listening to Carbon Shock with Mark Shapiro. He reviews the financial front lines of climate change. You can hear this program at 96.5 FM in the Sacramento area, or you can go to accesssacramento.org, or you can download this program from greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
But the other thing that I was thinking of is maybe you've got the military, that's pretty big, is something you might not assume is the case, but it's the crop insurance program of the United States. The crop insurance program, which subsidizes the ability of farmers to obtain insurance to insure their crops against altered conditions in growing. Government Accountability Office actually found last year that basically the crop insurance system was under severe threat because of all the monumental payouts that are being made to deal with the consequences of the climate change-induced changes in the conditions for farmers, whether it's drought, floods, extreme heat. And so, which has prompted the USDA for the first time to start making statements about climate change because of the money that it's costing the USDA. So that's one small example of an externalized cost. Not a small example, a large example of externalized cost. Just a quick little tour of the externalized costs, just to make things kind of real for a moment. I was just down in New Orleans about 2 months ago, and I actually spent time traveling, walking along the levees that have been built after Katrina, and to withhold the rising sea and the next storm that comes through. A huge monumental concrete barrier that cost us, you and me, $14 billion. So climate change, of course, does not cause hurricanes. We know that. So let's get way beyond that. What it does do is it intensifies the hurricanes and the extreme weather events that come. So a huge proportion of that money is can be ascribed to the effects of climate change. And scientists are involved in what exact percentage, and that's another question, but certainly a significant percentage. Climate change, there's other words for climate change. Maybe the way to think about climate change is with other words. People think about climate change, and they think climate change is kind of spooky. It's sort of out there. It's kind of happening way out there in the atmosphere. But there, and it may be happening in the future, and it's going to be happening down the line decades from now. But Lexi, why don't you call, next time you think of climate change, why don't you think of food crisis, which the FAO is now predicting there's going to be a food crisis because of immense stresses on the world's food. It's going to be a security threat, as I talked about with the EU and the U.S., both identifying this as a security threat. So there's a language issue here, and part of the reason I wrote this book was to begin to identify the many ways in which we're already paying for fossil fuels in ways we don't normally associate with climate change. And in a way, the debate, we've been having this illusory debate in the United States, and this is kind of what I wanted to strike at, because the debate has been over, do we, for example, establish a price for carbon or do we not? Do we spend the money to invest and support renewable energy sources in the United States or do we do not? As if it's an economic calculation which we're dealing with all the numbers that are in front of us. But the fundamental illusion at the core of that debate is essentially that we haven't been accounting for the full cost of all this fossil fuels. And let me tell you, for those of you who are familiar with environmental issues, this notion of externalized costs is one that's been around for a long time. This is nothing new. I'm not like saying anything new about this question. But and I've been doing environmental journalism for Jesus like 30 years, so quite some time. And every time, whether it's toxic chemicals, pesticides, climate change, whatever it might be, there's always the question of externalized costs. I got tired of hearing the term. I got so tired of it, I just didn't want to hear it. It would put me to sleep, as it might be, hopefully not you at the moment. So what I did with my book, I really wanted to go out and show what those externalized costs are, what they feel like, where and how they're being experienced and people's response to them. And that was essentially one of the motives of this book, was to take a global journey and basically identify where those and how they're taking place. Because the climate change is happening in many, tend to think in very abstract terms about climate change. It's happening now in every single form of our lives. It is impacting the way that farmers are going to grow their food, the way that cities are designed over the coming decades, the way that huge food processing firms obtain, which food they obtain and from where. This is impacting, which is every kind of level of economic decision making across the spectrum, which is why I called this book Carbon Shock, because that's what climate change is delivering to our economic order. And I describe that in the book, of course. So In Carbon Shock, I try to articulate the actual costs of climate change. And my point is, in order to make the educated decisions that a society has to make in terms of how we allocate resources, we need to step out of this illusion that fossil fuels are somehow cheaper and look honestly at the costs and then decide. That's basically what why I wrote the book. And I did it in such a way, hopefully, that is actually quite – that is actually readable. I spent a lot of time developing stories and finding people in the Amazon jungle who are actually contending with some of the shifts in the Amazon and also trying to struggle with preserving forests where people actually live as carbon sinks, because forests are the best way to suck CO2 out of the atmosphere. But it gets very complicated when you're dealing with both people who live in those forests, and they don't want to become offsets for Chevron Oil or General Motors. And you have fundamental shifts in those areas that are actually changing kind of life patterns in the Amazon, and all the way to the Central Valley, where you have farmers who are contending on a daily basis with climate change. A lot of them would say, I don't know what the hell you want to call it, but something out there changed. You want to call it climate change? Call it climate change. Something out there is changing. It's just not like it ever was before. Cherry farmers, peach farmers, almond farmers, tomato farmers, melon farmers, they'll tell you the same thing. And they told me the same thing. They told me that. So the reason why this notion of a price for carbon is actually so important is because it enables us to provide, number one, an honest accounting for the cost of fossil fuels, and two, to create a more level playing field for competition with renewables. Solar energy, wind energy, there's been a false competition until now, which is that wind and solar operating at a disadvantage. If you believe in the free market, basically, the basic principles of the free, which we're all supposed to be living in this country, this thing called the free market, capitalism, etc. So one of the fundamental flaws of this kind of free market is that there is not an honest competition. There's not an honest accounting for the costs caused by fossil fuels. So when we begin to integrate those ideas, you end up with a far more level playing field with when it comes to solar and wind power and other kind of sources of renewables. So that was the point of the reporting that went into this book. And it ended up, I ended up writing along the way stories for Harper's Magazine about the carbon markets and the international carbon market and some of the ways they've attempted to apply a price for carbon. It gets really tricky when you start getting into geopolitical dynamics. I wrote about the battle that's still ongoing with the United States over and the European Union, battling over how to account for the costs of greenhouse gas emissions coming from airplanes. One of the big trade battles actually happening right now, right under your nose, your eyes, your radar screen, right under the popular radar screen, is this huge climate trade battle that's been going on after the European Union decided to begin charging airlines for the emissions coming from the back of their airplanes. Now, that brings us to the question of where is the action when it comes to dealing with climate change and the impacts of climate change. And I think what's actually very interesting, and I could give you a million sort of stories about, you know, the fossil fuel industries and et cetera, et cetera. I don't think that's as interesting as actually understanding where the action is and where the sources of tension are in the society as we move forward. Climate change basically challenges our existing – climate change requires a shift in our understanding of where we get energy, which is – I think should be evident. Everybody here, and I think you probably know quite a bit about that, and many other people in the audience probably know the specifics of how you wire up a solar system to the grid and distributed grid. I'm not going to go into that now because I think, number one, it's broadly understood as being one of the fundamental shifts that has to happen. But to get to that point where we undergo this change in the society, we need a fundamental shift in our paradigms of power. And that's where things really get interesting around climate change, because the if you look over the last 5 years, you see very significant historic challenges to the existing structure of our concept of national sovereignty. Of how the limits to national sovereignty, how does climate change challenge our notions of national sovereignty and what a nation state can regulate, right, with a pollutant that is clearly international, comes from everywhere and comes from nowhere. Where does the nation state fit into this question? And it also requires a fundamental re-understanding of the limits of legal jurisdiction. And when you watch the negotiations unfolding, as you will over the next year, you'll have negotiations unfolding in Peru in a week, which is essentially a run-up to the negotiations happening in Paris in 2015, where they're supposed to renegotiate a global climate treaty.
The government wants to take away my Uzi.
Mine too.
I'm annoyed.
And
diamondoid.
We're
a paranoid.
My guys have heard the story of the coming of a war.
Helicopters have just landed.
The UN is at our shore.
Pakistani and Sri Lankan troops have taken Baltimore. Our squad is marching on.
Glory, glory, paranoia. Shave your head and we'll deploy ya. If you're normal, we'll annoy ya.
We kooks are marching on. You can see us blast a bunny.
Hear my bullets ricochet.
You can see us raising money.
Charlton Heston, make my day.
You can see us on those TV ads.
We are the NRA. We clods are marching on. Give an Uzi automatic.
Defend rights of bazookas to be owned by every klutz. My name's Filbert.
Hazel.
I'm Pecan.
Pistachio.
We're not.
We are lunatics with microchips implanted in our butts. Oh, man. Rear guards are marching on. No one's gonna capture me. It's Janet Reno. Watch out or we'll be gone, 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 gone.
And now back to Harbin Schock and Mark Shapiro.
Watch for these areas of interesting tension. And I'll give you a couple of examples. When it comes to, so for example, we have this traditional idea that the nation state has the rights to regulate the land in which the nation state exists, of course, the territory of the nation state, the water. We have a treaty governing water rights, which I think is several miles off of everybody's coast. They get to regulate those waters. And there's been this deep presumption about the air, right? That there's, everybody has an airspace. Well, what's very interesting is this, and I'll show you all the ways in which this fundamental challenge is happening. And I write about this in detail here because I take an I take an airplane flight from San Francisco to Siberia. I recommend it. Siberia is an amazing place. It'll take your breath away if you can ever make it out there. And I went out to do some training of Russian journalists in environmental journalism. And it was one of the most extraordinary experiences I've had. In this kind of birch forest out way out in the forest, a big university there. And they brought in journalists from all over Siberia who were doing amazing work. Actually, I noticed that the further you got from Moscow, the more amazing journalism was happening in Russia. And it's really pretty, pretty incredible. And Novosibirsk, by the way, was always a center of kind of independent thinking within the Soviet Union, even because it's so far from Moscow and nobody wanted to go there. But it's an amazing big, city. And, so I flew from San Francisco to Novosibirsk to Siberia. It's about an 18-hour trip or something. And what was interesting about that trip was, my first leg of the flight was from San Francisco to Paris. During the course of that flight from San Francisco to Paris, my pilot on an Air France flight, the ticket was bought for me by the people doing the thing. By the time we got to Paris, the pilot of my flight had submitted our greenhouse gases coming from the back of the airplane to the aviation authorities in Paris. And we flew, you might probably broadly know, you have to fly all the way over United States or North America and then across the North Atlantic. We flew, broadly speaking, over Washington, D.C. Nobody from Washington, D.C. cared the slightest about the greenhouse gases coming from the back of the airplane that I was in. And yet, by the time we landed, the pilot had to tell the aviation authorities how much our plane had emitted. I personally had a carbon footprint of probably about 1,500 pounds for that trip, the trip all the way to Russia. Number one, I know about that because I interviewed the pilot, I didn't do it by kind of knocking on the cockpit door, by the way. So I'm not sure I recommend that kind of strategy. But I did introduce myself to the pilot before the plane took off, and I said, hi, I'm a journalist, and I'm curious about this greenhouse gases coming from airplanes, and I'd love to talk to you while we're flying. You know, I'm going to be sitting here. And he said, okay, you know, I'll try to come find you. And I didn't know anything was going to happen. So like 6 hours later, I was half dazed flying in this thing. The pilot came out, and we had this amazing chat as we hurtled on automatic pilot, by the way, over the North Atlantic, and talked about the greenhouse gas submission he had to make to the authorities in Paris. And the reason for that was because the EU had just passed this measure that said, guess what? Airlines are responsible for like at least 5% of emissions that are going into the atmosphere. And the emissions that come out of the back of your airplane are far more destructive to the atmosphere than the emissions that even come from automobiles. So the effort to basically regulate those emissions for the entire course of that flight, and here's why it's important going down the line, because about 65% of my flight was in American airspace, the United States of America airspace. About 20% of my flight was over the North Atlantic, which is kind of nowhere airspace, everybody's airspace, international airspace. And about 15% of the flight was in European airspace. And the Europeans were saying, we want airlines to buy emission allowances for all those emissions going in and out of Europe. And the response of the United States airline industry was to sue the European Union, which has never happened before, but it was quite a sight. United, Continental, and American Airlines sitting there at this very fine, beautiful, modern court building in Luxembourg. Beautiful Luxembourg has this place called the European Court of Justice, which is a very important legal institution, and is essentially the Supreme Court broadly. It's a different legal system, but it's the highest court within the European Union to arbitrate disputes with the European Union. And there were the three biggest American airlines suing the European Union to stop a law that had been passed by a democratic government. And that has never happened before. So if you want to talk about how climate change is changing our way of understanding the world and the interests that are at stake, that is a good one. And I describe that in the book in this kind of legal case and the arguments that each side made. And ultimately, the important thing about this case is to understand that the European Court of Justice, again, like the Supreme Court of the EU, issued a decision which said that the EU has the right to regulate emissions outside of its national frontiers because climate change trumps these other concerns about national authority. There were some other factors as well, but that was the main idea coming out of that case. Huge. That has never happened before. So if you're starting to look at a shifting shape of the international legal system, you look to that case. It's fascinating for law students. I think it's an amazing case to actually read, as I did, although I'm not a law student or a lawyer, but it's a fascinating document. But I want to raise the point because not only that, and I know we're running out of time and I want to leave some time here for questions and stuff, but I do want to correlate that not all this is just happening in some distant place in the European Union.
From the movie, The Great Dictator, Charlie Chaplin gives his final speech.
I'm sorry, but I don't want to be an emperor. That's not my business. I don't want to rule or conquer anyone. I should like to help everyone if possible. Jew, Gentile, black man, white. We all want to help one another. Human beings are like that. We want to live by each other's happiness, not by each other's misery. We don't want to hate and despise one another. In this world, there's room for everyone, and the good earth is rich and can provide for everyone. The way of life can be free and beautiful, but we have lost the way. Greed has poisoned men's souls, has barricaded the world with hate, has goose-stepped us into misery and bloodshed. We have developed speed, but we have shut ourselves in. Machinery that gives abundance has left us in want. Our knowledge has made us cynical, our cleverness hard and unkind. We think too much and feel too little. More than machinery, we need humanity. More than cleverness, we need kindness and gentleness. Without these qualities, life will be violent, and all will be lost. The aeroplane and the radio have brought us closer together. The very nature of these inventions cries out for the goodness in men, cries out for universal brotherhood, for the unity of us all. Even now, my voice is reaching millions throughout the world, millions of despairing men, women, and little children, victims of a system that makes men torture and imprison innocent people. To those who can hear me, I say, do not despair. The misery that is now upon us is but the passing of greed, the bitterness of men who fear the way of human progress. The hate of men will pass and dictators die. And the power they took from the people will return to the people. And so long as men die, liberty will never perish. Soldiers, don't give yourselves to brutes.
Men who despise you, enslave you, who regiment your lives, tell you what to do, what to think, and what to feel, who drill you, diet you, treat you like cattle, use you as cannon fodder. Don't give yourselves to these unnatural men, machine men with machine minds and machine hearts. You are not machines. You are not cattle. You are men. You have the love of humanity in your hearts. You don't hate. Only the unloved hate. The unloved and the unnatural. Soldiers, don't fight for slavery. Fight for liberty. In the 17th chapter of St. Luke it is written, the kingdom of God is within man. Not one man nor a group of men, but in all men, in you. You, the people, have the power. The power to create machines. The power to create happiness. You, the people, have the power to make this life free and beautiful. To make this life a wonderful adventure. Then in the name of democracy, let us use that power. Let us all unite. Let us fight for a new world. A decent world. That will give men a chance to work, that will give youth a future and old age a security. By the promise of these things, brutes have risen to power, but they lie. They do not fulfill that promise. They never will. Dictators free themselves, but they enslave the people. Now let us fight to fulfill that promise. Let us fight to free the world, to do away with national barriers, to do away with greed, with hate and intolerance. Let us fight for a world of reason. A world where science and progress will lead to all men's happiness. Soldiers, in the name of democracy, let us all unite!
Can you hear me? Wherever you are, look up, Hannah. The clouds are lifting. The sun is breaking through. We are coming out of the darkness into the light. We are coming into a new world, a kindlier world, where men will rise above their hate, their greed, and brutality. Look up, Hannah. The soul of man has been given wings, and at last he is beginning to fly. He is flying into the rainbow, into the light of hope, into the future.
And now for something completely different.